This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Modern Jewish History series. Tonight, talking about the Haskalah, Jewish Enlightenment. If you are listening to an MP3 recording, please join us at webyeshiva.org to experience the full online interactive experience. Okay, let me just turn the recorder on. Okay, there you go. Sorry about that. I had muted myself. I was talking to somebody else for a second. I wanted to have a discussion tonight about the Enlightenment, what in here, or the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, which is the common term for the Jewish Enlightenment. It is an outgrowth of the larger European movement called the European Enlightenment. What is the Haskalah? Haskalah, in contemporary or colloquial modern Hebrew, Haskalah is a term that we use here. You see the term here, Haskalah. You can all see the board. The board is up. Yes? Okay. Haskalah is a term used to mean education, specifically higher education usually, but Haskalah does not mean education. It's from the same shoresh as seichel. Seichel means a type of intelligence. In Yiddish we know it as seichel. To say that somebody has seichel means they have smarts. But the Enlightenment, the Haskalah, is not education, but it's more than common sense. In Yiddish it might have that connotation as well. But the Haskalah is not education, but Enlightenment. In German, you'll pardon my atrocious German pronunciation. In German, the term, again, Germany is the home address for the European Haskalah. Germany and France as well, but Germany is really the capital of the European Enlightenment. The term is Aufklärung, which from the same root as the English word clear, but clear in the sense of bright, a shining. Light, and in the 18th century, light is connected to understanding. So therefore, the Maskilim, or the Haskalah, chooses that name for itself because of its connection to understanding, to Seichel. The Haskalah, and here we're really moving into modern Jewish history. Until now, we've talked about a number of different phenomena, all of which are on the peripheries of modern history, and depending upon how you slice it, the topic that we talked about in our very first session, what makes something modern, or what's modern about modern Jewish history, so you could debate it here or there, what become the lines of demarcation, but les man de poleg l'chol adeot, everyone agrees that the Enlightenment has 2 feet on both sides of the modern dividing line. And the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, is the first movement within Judaism to base itself on an outside movement, on the European Enlightenment. And this was, in and of itself, this is a radically new and innovative feature, to have a mass movement within Jewish culture, which is based exclusively on a trend in general culture. For Hellenism is a good question. I think that there are probably some differences. There was an influence of the general culture on Jews in that period. Here, there are Jews that are creating a movement of their own that's based on an outside movement. We could split hairs one way or the other. The mentality of the European Enlightenment was, pardon me, the mentality of the European Enlightenment is this emphasis on culture. So therefore, Voltaire, who's French, he's not German. Voltaire, here's his picture, 1694 to 1778. Voltaire is a French essayist and writer and thinker and a novelist. Voltaire was a pen name. His original name escapes me, but thanks to Wikipedia, I'm sure you can find more than you want to know about Voltaire. Voltaire is one of the grand old men of the European Enlightenment, not so much as a philosopher as much as a man of letters, as an author. And a number of times we've looked at works of culture or even works of fiction for their thank you, Alan, for their picture that they help us paint about the times. So Voltaire writes a book called Candide. We might have looked at a piece from Candide. I'm not sure. I'm guessing that you can even find it online in English translation. If you can, I'm sure somebody's going to post it. Let's have a contest between Joel and Alan who can post the link first. Candide is a book. It's published in 1759, and it deals with the theme of this character. The main character, his name is Candide. He's a good man, but he has no, what we would call, yichus. He's got no, he's not a member of the aristocracy. He's not well-born. He's got no education, per se. But he succeeds because of culture. Immanuel Kant, perhaps the most significant figure. There you go. Alan has linked us to, you can read it online, Candide. Immanuel Kant, perhaps the greatest philosopher of the period, he writes this essay called What is Enlightenment? Was ist Aufklärung? In 1784. A kind of statement of, and here's the link, I did it this time, here's a link to the essay itself. You can read the full essay, but if you Google "What is Enlightenment" and Kant, you'll find a number of different versions of it translated into English. In this kind of programmatic essay, What is enlightenment? Kant writes, "Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without guidance from another. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. Sapere aude, Latin for dare to know, was the motto of my high school, actually. Dare to know. Have courage to use your own understanding. That is the motto of the Enlightenment." So take a second, reread these four or five lines to yourself, and let's try to distill this into a notion about what the Enlightenment is about, and what might that mean for Jewish culture in the 18th century. Think about it for a moment, and I'd like to hear some thoughts on that. Hold on. Let's hear people's voices. Alan, I'm going to unmute you. Alan, elaborate a moment on what you're writing here. Alan? Yeah.
Yes.
So just, I'd like people to hear other people's voices.
Well, it seems to be sort of this self-contained state that exists where you're not looking to others for guidance, you're sort of relying on your own understanding. I guess enlightenment is to somehow develop that understanding without that sort of self-imposed limitation.
Right, the self-imposed limitation being a reliance on, here he says, a reliance, a guidance from another. The idea that you can't be, you can't be what? Yeah, and any source outside of oneself. So both Tehillaleah. Tehillaleah, would you mind speaking up? Let me unmute you. Are you there, Tila? Tila? So elaborate on what you were saying. Right. Right. Well, or not only to design your own religion, but it opens the possibility of a society which isn't rooted in the authority of religion, which was, of course, the central domineering authority in medieval Europe up until this point. So as you've cast it, both Tilalea and Sherry in the comments have cast it in a particularly Jewish light, but in other words, Kant, of course, was not Jewish. Voltaire, of course, was not Jewish. What they're writing here outside of the Jewish context, they're talking about general European culture to make a sense. Right, right. Decentralized authority and with a sense that individuals are endowed with both the autonomy to reason for themselves, to collectively form a society. Sherry writes to design your own morality. I'm not sure that that's the case. There are still consensus of society and civilization, but that is an outgrowth not of some sense of the divine right of kings, that there's some kind of authority that's imposed from above, but something that grows up organically from the grassroots, as it were, to use an anachronistic term. And the source of it is what? Right. In other words, Joel points out that Kant said that the absolute moral law lies within man, within ourselves, or in the words and the felicitous words of that other great Enlightenment document, not from Germany, not from France, but from the good old USA, we the people. That the source of law, the source of the social mores lies within the consensus of the people themselves. So Kant says the problems of society lie in the inability of people to make use of their own understanding. And therefore the Enlightenment it's anti-aristocratic and it's also anti-organized or central religion, at least as at least as conceived up until that point. It's very much looking to the perfection of society, the perfection of the world through culture, and that's the way in which we we're led to be smarter or to be maskilim, to be enlightened, to understand, to have insight. I posted earlier today onto the Shear's webpage, where obviously I don't have time to go through all of it, a very large number of primary sources that deal with the Enlightenment and with the related topic of the emancipation, which I hope we'll get to. I really recommend that you take a look at that and go through with it, go through it. But for example, you have there Frederick II's charter, the Charter Decree for the Jews of Prussia from 1750, which is a you know, an interesting kind of mixed document. It's part medieval and it's part modern. If you look at this is, by the way, all of these are from a book called The Jew in the Modern World, which was edited by Paul Mendesflor and Yehuda Reinhartz, two very distinguished professors of history. It's usually used as a source book or textbook for a survey course in Jewish history, either in high school when I taught AP Jewish History in high school. I use this book, but it's also used on college campuses. This edition, the 1980 edition, I think has been superseded by a subsequent edition, which I don't have, but I'm sure that you could get this online. There isn't a full text version of the whole book online, although many of the documents are available online. If you were to, you know, get the table of contents, I'm sure you'd be able to find many of the documents online, but you would be lacking the one of the good features of the book. And I imagine that the second edition of the book, which Alan just sent you a link for from Amazon, one of the nice features of the book are the footnotes and the introductory pieces to each document, and then the notes that go along with it. But I assume that most of the sources are available online. You just have to make sense of them yourself. So, for example, here in the note to this to the charter to Frederick II's charter, Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, he points out that Jacob Rader Marcus, who was also a very significant American Jewish historian in America, who also edited another important book called The Jew in the Medieval World. That's an anthology of primary sources dealing with medieval Jewish history. And this book, it deals with modern Jewish history. Marcus pointed out that this charter is a curious combination of medieval and modern elements. It's modern in the sense that the Jew is thought of to be no longer a ward of the king, but instead a subject of the state, albeit a second-class citizen. Oh, lost my video. There's my video. The former Jewish autonomy is broken down, and the Jew is brought closer to the state economically, politically, culturally. The charter is medieval, however, in the sense that it's filled with a spirit of distrust and a contempt for the Jew, limiting him almost exclusively to commerce and industry. But these sources in this little packet that I put together really are worth your time to print it out and to look it over. If you have any problems accessing it through the website, email me and I will email it to you. The Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, originates in 18th century Germany. In the mid 18th century in Germany, the Jewish population of the collection of German states and city-states, we talked a little bit about this in our first session, You can look in the archives for that. The whole Jewish population of Germany, of what we call Germany today, was about 125,000 Jews, which is less than 1% of the total population. That being said, even though we were a very, very, very distinct minority, we were a distinct minority. 1% of the population, somehow we captured the imagination of, the entire area. And already, 200 years before Hitler, the Jewish question of who these people are and how do they fit in was already ever present in questions of how to organize the society. The Haskalah, which again is a Western European phenomena, it's Germany, it's France, spreads ultimately to Eastern Europe, to Poland, to Russia, although there it plays out in a different way, which we'll talk about. The figure without whom we can't talk about the Haskalah is, of course, Moses Mendelssohn. There he is. Moses Mendelssohn, 1729 to 1786. We also discussed him a little bit in the first session, and I refer you to that to the archives for that. Mendelssohn, his name was Mendelssohn, but in other words, he was Moshe ben Menachem Mendel. That's how he gets the last name Mendel's son Ben Mendel. He's born in Dessau in 1729. He's the son of a sofer, of a ritual scribe. He received a traditional education under a rav by the name of David Frankel, who was the rabbi of Dessau. And when this Frankel leaves Dessau and moves to Berlin in 1743, the young Mendelssohn, who was just, a bit past bar mitzvah, travels with him to Berlin, both to follow his rabbi, as well as, he says, to obtain a general education, which was pretty rare for Jews in those days. In general, Mendelssohn's philosophic theories are very much rooted in 17th and 18th century rationalism. And if what Mendelssohn writes, it's very popular to kind of denigrate Mendelssohn. Everyone likes to point out that Mendelssohn, the grandfather of the Jewish Enlightenment, was also the grandfather of non-Jews, that his children were already no longer observant whatsoever, and his grandchildren were no longer even Jewish, at least by and large, all either having, I mean, they were Jewish halachically, at least the children of his daughters, but his sons, I think some of his children intermarried, and some of them converted to Christianity, and his grandchildren were all no longer raised Jewish, were not culturally Jewish. His most celebrated grandson being Felix Mendelssohn, the very famous European composer. But he himself, Moses Mendelssohn himself, was completely observant. He was completely Shomer Torah Mitzvot. Even though there's this kind of fashion amongst contemporary orthodoxy to try to highlight how vile his opinions and his contribution to Jewish history was. In fact, he was thoroughly observant. Even his philosophy is not so much a it's not even if it's not completely in agreement with conventional rabbinic thought, neither is it directly an attack on it. Neither is it directly in contradiction with rabbinic thought, with a few exceptions. He had particular notions about free will, which don't seem to fit in with conventional rabbinic thought. He essentially thought that free will is not really possible from a philosophic standpoint, and that raises all types of questions about how schar v'onesh works, how reward and punishment works, because if you don't have free will, so then, as the Rambam has pointed out, that the idea of reward and punishment is predicated on the idea of absolute free will, because without free will, then the whole notion of reward and punishment is fairly meaningless. But besides that one particular nugget of philosophical disagreement, by and large, he's not making an attack on conventional Jewish thought. One of his main theories is this notion of the division between what he called eternal truths, amitot nitzchiot, eternal truths, which are self-evident to reason, and historical or temporal truths, what he called the zmaniot, the amitot zmaniot, which are require the evidence of our own experiences, the evidence of our own senses, of our own ability to rationalize them. Among the eternal truths, of course, says Mendelssohn, is the belief in God, and in the immortality of the soul. These are eternal truths. They are the foundations of religion. But that there's a different realm of truth which we can intuit. He stresses the use of German before he becomes very widely known. He studies general philosophy, secular philosophy, and this leads to him being noticed. People start paying attention to him. Who is this Jew? He was often described as being, you know, ugly. He was sickly, and he had a hunchback. He was this very unusual character. He looks like a Jew. He talks like a Jew. He has, you know, in the caricatures of him, you know, he's got a hook nose, but he's noticed by some significant philosophers and theologians. There's a fellow named John or Johann Caspar Lavater, Lavater, who's a leading Lutheran theologian in Germany, and he kind of goads Mendelssohn into a debate to defend Judaism. Lavater was motivated by a desire to kind of rescue Christianity from the Enlightenment. And he kind of thought that the conversion of the Jews to Christianity, particularly the most famous Jew in Europe, to Christianity, would be, you know, some kind of vindication and would show the superiority of Christianity over Judaism. Mendelssohn doesn't want to debate him for a number of reasons. He says, number one, Judaism is binding only on the Jews, and we Jews don't missionize. So basically, says Lavater, why don't you just, you know, like, leave us alone? We'll deal with what the things that we think we're obligated in, and you take care of yourself, and we're not going to bother you, and I'm not interested in debating you. But he also thought that fundamental concepts and matters of faith and belief aren't subject to debate, particularly given that they serve as the basis for moral society, that the Torah for Jews and Christian belief for Christians serve as the basis for parallel moral societies, and therefore these are not matters that are subject to debate. Each person can believe it's a type of a pluralism, in which each side can believe that they are the possessor of the truth or of a truth. And as long as we're not bothering each other, what do we need to have a debate to determine what's the ultimate, which one is correct and which one is incorrect? And finally, of course, from a practical standpoint, as long as the Jews were a minority and a not privileged minority at that, it's best not to dispute, as the Rambam had learned 500 or almost 500 years earlier. The Ramban, in his famous debate with the church, apparently he made a terrible mistake in his debate. He won. He provided a very, very sound argument in a debate whose conclusion was foregone, that the Ramban could not win. And this, of course, caused some trouble. The strain of this. Hold on one second. The strain of this kind of a controversy led to a folks, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to hold on one second. I'll be right back. I'm sorry, folks, I'm back. Child returning from a bar mitzvah found the front door locked. I apologize about that. So the strain of this controversy led to like something of a nervous breakdown, and for a period of years he was unable to write. He was unable to engage in kind of public activities, and it leads him to a realization that there's a real barrier between his world and that of the enlightened non-Jews, and that he needs to kind of appraise both worlds. He decides to kind of return to the source, especially to Tanakh, to the Bible, more so than rabbinic literature. And in 1783, he publishes a book called Jerusalem, which is his most thorough philosophical statement. It's not clear why he titles the book Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, really doesn't play any kind of prominent role in the book, but it's a work of a real statement of his views about Judaism's role in the world and the role of the Jew in the world, particularly issues related to church and state. Sherry makes mention of that. Here's a quotation for it from it. Again, this is a selection from his work called Jerusalem. The title of this particular piece is called The Right to be Different. Let's just see. Right. Let's just read a little piece of this. Mendelssohn writes, "Brethren, if it be genuine piety you are aiming at, let us not feign consonance when manifoldness is evidently the design and end of providence. None of us feels and thinks exactly alike with his fellow man. Then wherefore impose upon one another by deceiving words? We are, alas, prone enough to do so, in our ordinary transactions, in our general conversation, comparatively of no material importance. But wherefore also in things involved our spiritual and temporal welfare, and constituting the whole purpose of our creation? God has not stamped on every man a peculiar countenance for nothing. Why, then, should we, in the most solemn concerns of life, render ourselves unknown to one another by disguise? Is not this resisting providence so far as lies with us? Is not frustrating the designs of creation, if it were possible, and purposely acting against our vocation and destiny, both in this life and that to come? Regents of the earth, if an insignificant fellow inhabitant of it may be allowed to lift up his voice unto ye, oh, listen not to the counselors, who in smooth words would misguide you to so pernicious an undertaking. They are either blind themselves and cannot see the enemy of mankind lurking in ambush, or they want to blind you. If you hearken to them, our brightest jewel, freedom of conscience, is lost. For your happiness' sake, and for ours, religious union is not toleration. It is diametrically opposite to it. For your happiness' sake, and for ours, lend not your powerful authority to the converting of law into immutable truth, without which civil happiness may very well subsist. The forming of a public ordinance, any theological thesis, if no importance to the state. Be strict as to the life and conduct of men. Make that amenable to the tribunal of wise laws. And leave thinking and speaking to us, just as it was given us, as an inalienable heirloom, as we were invested with it in an unalterable right by our universal Father." Etc., etc., etc. Here, let me just skip ahead. Reward and punish no doctrine. Hold out no allurement or bribe for the adoption of theological opinions. Let everyone who does not disturb public happiness, who is obedient to the civil government, who acts righteously towards you and towards his fellow countrymen, be allowed to speak as he thinks fit, to pray to God after his own fashion, or after that of his forefathers, and to seek eternal salvation where he thinks he may find it. In other words, it's more than just separation of church and state. It's a statement that not separation of church and state is like a practical or a technical mode, but a statement that public life and the private sphere of religion, which again was something deeply important to him, the religious life, but these are wholly separate and autonomous realms. And as long as a person, be he Jew, be he Gentile, be he even atheist, it can be a constructive member of society, leave him alone. Let him be allowed to think as he see fits, to pray to God after his own fashion, etc., etc., etc. His well-known line, his well-known notion that, again, this is a piece that's being written for external consumption. For internal consumption, he had this famous line in which he says that we ought be a Jew in the home and man in the street, to be a mensch in the German sense, mensch, not in the Jewish sense of mensch of somebody with good characteristics, but to be a man in the street and a Jew in the home, is not a call for assimilation. That line is often misunderstood to say, like religion is the realm of the private, and when you're outside, you should take off your yarmulke and blend in, and nobody should know. That wasn't the point. The point was that we can simultaneously exist in both realms. That there's not inherently a contradiction. It's not a call for assimilation. It does open the gate, the floodgate, to assimilation, tragically so, and to conversion, in the 19th century. But Mendelssohn himself thinks that you can do both, and maybe he could. He was an extraordinarily intelligent, brilliant mind, and maybe he was able to do both. Maybe he was able to dance at two weddings, as it were. But it's possible that in the 18th century, he was the exception, not the rule. And it's possible that he didn't understand this. He was deeply hurt by the rabbinic opposition to what he and his followers were trying to do. There's almost a certain amount of naivete, that he didn't fully understand why there was such opposition. He had conflicts with the Rav Yaakov Emden, the famous Rav Yaakov Emden, over certain issues, particularly related to burial issues, and certain civil regulations for how burial would be carried out, etc., etc., etc. These were some of the issues that he was involved with. In 1781, somebody by the name of Serf Bear, who was the leader of French Jewry in Alsace. Alsace is a region in northeast France, which is on the border with Germany, and at certain periods it's part of France, certain periods it's part of Germany. So this figure, Serf Bear, turns to Mendelssohn, asking him to author an essay supporting the emancipation of French Jewry. Remember, the French Revolution only takes place in 1789. This is 1781. And they're making an argument to emancipate. We think of emancipation, the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln freeing the slaves. But essentially, that's what Jewish emancipation was like, although in a very different way. The idea that Jews would be granted full and equal citizenship by their host society. Mendelssohn thinks that it would be more effective for a non-Jew to write this manifesto, and he turns to somebody named Christian Wilhelm von Dohm. Again, pardon my German accent. Let me see if I can't find it. We also have this here. Here you go. It's on page 8 of this packet. Here, Christian Wilhelm von Dohm writes this essay called "Concerning the Amelioration of the Civil Status of the Jews." He was a this Dohm was a friend of Mendelssohn's. He was an official in the Prussian government, and a noted Enlightenment figure on his own. At the same time, in the same around the same time, I think in the same year, Joseph II issues his Edict of Tolerance, which you also have here. Joseph II is he's the king of Germany. He's the head of the Holy Roman Empire, and he issues this edict, which is addressed to the Jews or to the people in Austria or a part of Austria, which is designed to end the social and economic isolation of the Jews in that part, and with a particular eye towards rendering them useful to society, and to the state. It outlawed the official use of Yiddish. Yiddish becomes this this lightning rod in the Haskalah battles, because it becomes a sign of old style Judaism. And it encourages secular education, and because of this, it was viewed very, very suspiciously. And those things in the Edict of Joseph II are already, you know, foreshadowed in Dohm's propositions here, with a notion that we can ameliorate, we can solve, we can improve the civil status of the Jews by making certain reforms. I'm not here referring to what will become known as Reform Judaism. We'll talk about that in due course. But that there are certain ways that we can integrate the Jews into general society that will make them productive citizens of the nation, of civilization, of society. And Dohm becomes this kind of bedrock statement, this argument for emancipation, for granting Jews full citizenship. Mendelssohn, although he had kind of drafted Dohm to write that, Mendelssohn was not completely satisfied with what Dohm wrote, for various reasons. In some ways, Mendelssohn was even more radical than Dohm. His own work, the work Jerusalem, which comes out the following year, is, you know, his then attempt to make his own statement about his beliefs and about the role of Jews within larger German society. I'm going to just skip ahead a little bit. Let me go back here. Let me just quickly outline some of the main ideologies and characteristics of the Haskalah. One was this kind of impulse to negate the sense of Jewish alienation in the exile. There was this, you know, sense of the galut, that we Jews, we don't belong here in Germany, we don't belong here in France, we don't belong here in England. It's a negative historical phenomena that we should even be here in the first place. This is, you know, of course, viewed by the general society as a very negative feature. How could these people be, how could these Jews be integrated into our society, even if we would want to do so, which general culture was not always open to doing, if they're so negative about being here? So one of the characteristics was this notion of doing away with that sense of alienation about living in the exile, about living in Europe, with the hope that this would lead to our being accepted in those societies through political emancipation. There was also a desire to promote Jewish productivity, that Jews should enter certain crafts, that Jews should enter the agricultural realm, things that Jews were not traditionally involved in, and to move away from kind of the merchandising and money lending and these other types of trades and professions that Jews were classically involved in, to move them to more what were considered more productive trades, which would also, help to remove certain stigmas. There's a certain anti-messianic impulse. This may be fueled partially by the memories only a century or so old of the failure of Shabtai Tzvi. You remember him. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago. But also this sense that we are members of European society. We are here to stay. We are casting our lot with our host society, and either at best a de-emphasis or at worst a real negation of messianic thought, which is of course at the bedrock of Jewish culture, is a feature of the Haskalah, or certainly the later Haskalah, so that when the Reform movement comes around a generation or so after Mendelssohn, and they revise the Sidur, they revise the Tefillah, all of those references to the Messianic age are either removed or cast in such a way that they're speaking so metaphorically that it's talking about the perfection of society and not about the actual advent of a Messiah king who will come and redeem the Jewish people and return them to Israel. That feature, combined with the rise of, generally of nationalism throughout Europe in the 19th century, will actually lead to Zionism. This notion that not to the movement that we call religious Zionism, but political Zionism, the idea that we ought work for redemption through natural agencies, not sitting passively waiting for some kind of divine agency. This is an irony that the Haskalah sets off to make a point about Jews being at home in their host culture, which leads in a different way to a movement which will draw Jews away from the host culture. But, history is full of all types of ironies. There's a sense of the importance of identification as citizens first. Be a Jew in the street, be a mensch in the street, and also a Jew at home. That we identify as Germans or Frenchmen or Englishmen, and that even the whole notion of the term Jew takes on its pejorative sense, and so that the term of choice becomes not Jew but Israelite, which is a more perhaps a more elegant term. The idea that we're the Israelites, hearkening back to the biblical roots. Ultimately, of course, the Haskalah leads to an attempt to reform, to improve, to enlighten Judaism itself, and that's of course the Reform movement. But also a sense of Judaism as a culture, and less so as a religion. So there's this interest in Jewish history, the origins of Jewish history as an academic discipline, go back to this period, to biography, to an attempt to try to correlate the great cultural contributions of the Jews throughout the history, the Wissenschaft movement, the Wissenschaft des Judentums, which is the scientific study of Judaism, studying Judaism, not Talmud Torah, not studying Torah lishma, the topic we spoke about last week, but studying about Judaism and about Jewish culture and Jewish writings, and the idea that we can look at Jewish literature. The revival of Hebrew very much comes out of this, both because it's the anti-Yiddish, but also because it's a return to classical Jewish culture. These are some of the characteristics and ideologies of the Haskalah. Next time we'll maybe spend one more session. Next time maybe we'll spend one more session talking about some of the other things that grow out of this in the next generation. Of the Haskalah. If you're able, take a look at some of these documents in the packet, particularly this piece by Lessing, this play called The Jews. It's another example of it was a play. Here's the script. You know, there are characters here: the Baron, the Traveler, the Baron's daughter. It's a sense in which, again, culture. Here we're talking about a stage play, both reflecting a certain sense of where the society was holding, as well as a primary document which we can look to for historical purposes to try to distill this, and also very important is to look at this section from Naftali. Here, Wesley in Hebrew is called Wiesel, the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, the words of peace and truth, which is of course a quote. The Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, it's a quote from the very end of Megillat Esther, which we just read. Of course, this is a Jew writing about it's a call to the Jews on how we might move forward to improve ourselves so that we might be granted full and equal footing to the general culture. So if you have a chance, try to look at these things before we meet next week. Just two concluding points. Number one, from a traditional point of view, from a religious point of view, the Enlightenment and the Haskalah, particularly insofar as it led to some devastating and tragic results in drawing people away from not just Jewish observance, but even Jewish culture, the very same Jewish culture that it tried to elevate onto a pedestal, was just as a historical tragedy. On the other hand, we are all of us, no matter how observant or non-observant you are, and of course I'm speaking as an Orthodox rabbi, we are all of us in some way the children of the Enlightenment. All of us living in the modern world live in the world that Mendelssohn envisioned. And if we're successful, we really are the Jew in the home and the mensch in the street, and we've either succeeded or we aspire to be the opposite as well, to be the Jew in the street and the mensch in the home, that we've somehow been able to move a step past that and to integrate the two, or at least we aspire to. There were, of course, very severe rabbinic opposition. There was very severe rabbinic opposition to what Mendelssohn and his cohort were doing. But there were also attempts, perhaps most famously initially by Rav Shimshon Frel Hirsch, and we'll talk about him hopefully in a week or so, to make recognition of the challenge that Mendelssohn was facing, and to offer a religious response, which was not in opposition to, but was emanating from a different place and with perhaps a different goal, or perhaps even with the same goal. So there's this ambivalence that we feel to some of these notions has to be balanced with the fact that we are all very much living in a world created by, we're living in Judaism that's influenced by you know, these ideas that Mendelssohn was wrestling with. The second point I just wanted to make, I hope you saw this email I sent yesterday. Apparently in the last shiur I made a terrible slip of the tongue, and I misidentified Nevardik and Slobotka. I mixed up their world views, as it were. Again, I said last time. The Slobotka. We were talking about the Musar movement. The Slobotka style of Musar was the one that noted that man was but an inch away from the angels, and if we strive to achieve our greatness, you know, trying to lift us up. And it was the Navardic style of Musar that, again, gross oversimplification, it's the Navardic style of Musar that, you know, was a little more critical and was a little more about negating the ego and pulling you down. And I, slip of my tongue, I mix those two up. That was brought to my attention through one of our students named Joseph Sonnenblick, who apparently just participates in the shiurim through the archives. But he also mentioned in that email a book which I've actually been relying on and I wanted to bring to your attention. It's Jacob Katz's Tradition and Crisis: Jewish Society at the End of the Middle Ages, which is a really wonderful book, and insofar as you know, part of what we are doing is trying to expose you to the best that's been said and written on these matters, I recommend this book to you. There are two. This book was written by Jacob Katz, who was, you know, one of the grand old men of the study of Jewish history, of modern Jewish history and early modern Jewish history. He passed away at a ripe old age only a couple of years ago. Katz, K-A-T-Z, Jacob Katz. The book, of course, was written in Hebrew, and it was translated into English twice. It's pretty rare for a book to be translated twice into English. And if you do get the book, you should certainly get the later edition, which was translated by Bernard Dove Cooperman, 1993, by Shokin Books, and I'm sure that you can also get this on Amazon. Again, it's called Tradition and Crisis: Jewish Society at the End of the Middle Ages. So if you have a chance, please try to look over some of those documents before next time. There's that link. Somebody wanted the link to the Kant piece, which seems to be on the website of the University of Pennsylvania. But again, if you Google "What is Enlightenment" and Immanuel Kant, you'll find various versions of the full essay. This is just what we looked at, is just the opening sentence or two. I will stay online if anybody has any questions. and good evening.